fire rescue, EMS, law enforcement. These are the three components of public safety, and those who answer the call are the first responders. Welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. I'm your host, Steve Green. Five Alarm Task Force presents some of the best instructors and mentors in public safety today to educate, elucidate, and entertain. No topic is out of bounds, and every opinion has value. Five Alarm Task Force is promoted by our partners, Dalmatian Productions, Inc., The Firehouse Tribune, FireTech, makers of on-scene soot and ash decon products, Hennessy Distributing, your source for the new cool towel, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, fighting to extinguish firefighter cancer since 2004, and the Great Florida Fire School. Remember, our ultimate goal is for you to be safe and return home after every call. So insert those earphones or turn up those speakers. The 5 Alarm Task Force is being dispatched right now. The second annual Surviving the Fire Service Conference will be held on February 27, 2018 at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Billed as a behavioral health and cancer prevention conference, the event will feature speakers including Pat Morrison, the IAFF Assistant General President for Health, Safety, and Medicine, Dr. Denise Smith, Research Scientist at IFSI, and Captain Frank Lito, Deputy Director of the FDNY Counseling Unit, who will speak about health challenges in the fire service. There will also be a panel discussion on cancer in the fire service, as well as a presentation on tragedy and loss within the fire service from a chaplain's point of view. And a portion of the fees go to help the survivors of fallen firefighters. Additional information, including registration, can be found at http://nova.edu/conference/index.html, or send an email to us, dalmatprod@outlook.com, and we will be happy to send you the link. That's the 2017-2018 Surviving the Fire Service Conference on February 27th at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale. Make your reservations today. We want to take a moment to tell you about one of our great sponsors, the Firehouse Tribune. Firehouse Tribune is an emergency services web-based platform where individuals can learn, train, and share ideas and experiences. In life, both on and off duty, we live by one creed: excellence is a habit, not a goal. Interested? Find them on Twitter at FH Tribune, and visit their website at www.thefirehousetribune.com. Remember to always work hard, stay safe, and live inspired. And welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. I'm your host, Steve Green, and we want to remind you that you can always find the podcasts on our website at bit.ly/5alarmpodcast, or you can find us on iTunes and Google Play. Just search for Five Alarm Task Force. And today our guest is David Wiglansky. I met him recently at the Great Florida Fire School. And David's a firefighter EMT with the New Brunswick Fire Department, currently assigned to the Suppression Section. He has nearly 20 years in emergency services. David is a highly known speaker and writer, most notably for his presentations on behavioral health in addition to suicide terrorism. His mission is to end the stigma associated with mental health and to connect responders with the available resources to not only survive, but thrive in their careers. His presentations have been followed at many seminars at the local, state, and national levels, and he has contributed articles to Fire Engineering, Firehouse Magazine, and the Firehouse Tribune. David has a BA in psychology from Keene University and an MA in Behavioral Sciences, Human Behavior, and Organizational Psychology from Keene University. He is on faculty at Keene University and Raritan Valley Community College, where he regularly lectures on all aspects of psychology. He holds certifications as a fire instructor too, an EMT instructor. He is also a New Jersey National Fallen Firefighters Foundation advocate and the owner of Alpha Omega Training Solutions. David, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Steve.
You know, it's very interesting that the interview I did before the holiday break was with the editor of Firehouse Magazine, Tim Sandelbach. And one of the things he mentioned that I found really telling and now is very appropriate for being with you as our guest today is the fact that as he reviews article submissions for the magazine, it used to be that the articles were about tactics, how to do this, how to approach that, and what to look for this. He says now, at a 4-to-1 ratio, the article's about behavioral health in the fire service.
Wow, I hadn't actually noticed that it was that high of a ratio, but that shows that we're definitely trending in the right direction.
Exactly. And I think, you know, most notably, and very recently on Twitter, we've seen a lot more tweets and discussion about behavioral health in the fire service. I've had several guests already on the show who've talked about how important it is, and we've talked about both behavioral health and firefighter suicide issues. And when we met and I listened to the opening of your presentation at the Great Florida Fire School on resilience, I really was floored by that, your opening message to the class, and felt that it was so important. And then having spoken with you as well briefly, that I thought it was very, very important that I bring you on as a guest to help you get that message out to all our listeners. And by the way, for our listeners, if you're just tuning in maybe for the first time, our stats now are amazing. We're now being heard, listened to in Canada, in the UK, Eastern and Western Europe, South America, the Philippines, Australia, and New Zealand. So when my guests talk, people are listening. And that's the most important. That's really the mission of this show, is to get these kind of messages out to our colleagues and friends. So, David, tell us about resilience and how that applies to this concept of behavioral health for us.
Well, resilience is generally how individuals adapt in a positive manner to stress and stressors, and most importantly, stressful situations, adversity, and risk. We understand that in emergency services, we are constantly challenged by the types of jobs that we go on. Granted, we're not going on fires every day, depending on where you work. You're not going on technical rescues every day. But even the minutia and the fire alarms, and unfortunately up here in the Northeast, I just spent 36 hours at work, and we ran more broken water pipes than I think we ever have in the past couple of years due to the weather that we're getting. But it starts to grind on you. And that resilience is your ability to bounce back from that and to adapt in such a way that we're not worried about the adverse effects. People who lack resilience as a whole generally just look at things as there's no light at the end of the tunnel. And when we lose hope and we lose optimism, we actually lose the ability to not only persevere and survive the day, but to thrive. Mm-hmm. I don't want somebody just merely to survive their career. I want them thriving. I want them to be able to come home physically well. We understand that physical fitness is incredibly important in this field. And I want them to come home mentally intact. We're losing too many guys to firefighter suicide. As you mentioned before, I noticed you had Jeff Dillon. He has a job that I envy. I'm just glad that he does it and I don't. I couldn't imagine dealing with the families and verifying the suicides like he does.
Right.
We need to start getting people to be more resilient. And unfortunately, the process of resilience to develop it takes time. And it's something that if we never bring it to the attention of recruits in either probie school or in EMT or in medic school, we're never going to develop that mindset that will allow us to get through our careers intact.
Right. And, you know, unfortunately, we have a lot of people who are still of the mind of the quote unquote suck it up generation. And, you know, that's especially some of the more experienced people who've got maybe 15, 20 years in ready there, maybe close to retirement. and their mentoring of the younger people, although they'll teach them tactics and they'll teach them everything on the truck and where the cabinets and everything like that. But when it comes to an issue where there might be a psychological impact there, they don't want to touch that. And they'll just say to the younger firefighter, well, suck it up. This is what we do. And we have to...
So it was when I got into the fire service.
It's the way I was.
The mindset was just simply, suck it up and deal with it, kid. You know, you're going to see bad things. And in a way, I almost wonder if, as an educator, I'm failing my students by not preparing them for the fact that not every job is going to resolve itself peacefully. In the EMS side of things, every patient that we seem to treat, the imaginary patients that we seem to treat in school, survives.
Right.
Unfortunately, we realize that's not the way it's actually going to be. And we don't address the impacts of death and dying very well. If I remember correctly, in the book that we're currently using, it should be five slides, literally five PowerPoint slides, address the death and dying aspect of it out of 1,500 pages of material, where we might need to be focusing more on the psychological wellness of our recruits so we could actually not only keep those people, but keep them functioning. It costs a lot of money to recruit and train someone, and then not to mention the unquantifiable amount of money from the experience that that person has that we're going to lose as a result of not keeping these people well.
Right. You know, it's that's an interesting point. When I got in the fire service, I was already working for in synagogues. And because of that, because of the level of my work there in as an educational director and executive director, I often had to deal with bereaved families and situations. And when the officer, our captain and the chief learned more of my background after I joined this combination department, I was often the one who was assigned on scene if there was a loss to initially be, you know, talk with the family and help them through it because I had dealt with it before. And I didn't mind doing it. I mean, I had done it before, as I said, and I knew how important it was, but I did find it interesting. This is way back in the late 70s that it was very difficult for anybody else to do that same task. And I was wondering, well, I've only been in, you know, a couple of months. Who was doing this before? And I finally asked the chief, and he said basically nobody, because nobody, you know, knew how to say other than, you know, we're very sorry, and kind of left it at that. And we can't do that.
No, we need to be able to better prepare our people. We can't go with the, I'm very sorry for your loss. That only goes so far. Because not only is it their loss at that point, it's the impact to your responder that simply uttering lip service to, we're very sorry for your loss, we did everything we could, doesn't really go a long way when we have type A personalities that are driven to succeed. And most of us are those type A personalities that failure is not an option. And then we view this death as a failure. So then how do we get past that? And if you go back to your station and it's, hey, kid, suck it up, you'll be fine. Or, hey, you know, my personal favorite, here, have another beer, it'll be okay. Well, now we're teaching you negative coping strategies that will ultimately translate into much bigger problems later on in the future if we don't deal with them appropriately.
Right. Let me ask you a question. Since you mentioned have another beer, when I was up upstate New York in the department up there, not ours, but I noticed a lot of departments, because I often traveled back and forth between Syracuse, where we lived, and Albany, where my in-laws lived, and stopped at numerous stations around in that area. A lot of them, of course, were volunteer or combination. And many of them had a bar. They actually had a full bar in the rec room of the station. We in ours outside of right outside of Syracuse, we didn't. That was wasn't allowed. Although there was one bar just up the street that everyone considered the station's hangout, but there was a rule that the chief had a rule that if you had one beer, you don't go on a call. You're not allowed. You have to stay at the station if you respond. And he'd prefer that you didn't even respond if you had a beer to the station. Is that still kind of prevalent up in the Northeast, that a lot of these state combination or volunteer stations still have bars in them?
I haven't noticed a lot. There's a couple that I've been to that have bars, but they have pretty much the same requirements where during things like training, you're not allowed to have the bar open. It's more for the social aspect. If they have a hall attached, like a banquet hall, that seems to be where the bar is.
Oh, okay.
A lot of programs up here have pretty aggressive policies about alcohol consumption and response. The volunteer house that I came from was one beer you don't drive and two you don't ride. And even that, I think, has been updated to simply, if you decide that you want to drink, that's fine. We don't have a problem with that. But please don't come. You become a liability at that point. And if not, just anything at all goes wrong, did the alcohol that was in your system contribute to that accident?
Right.
Or contribute to that event?
Very good point. Very good point. So how do we proceed from this point? I mean, your presentation was very intriguing, and it really is so telling for what we're seeing today. And how do we get this message out? We're trying our best with having you as a guest on Fire Alarm Task Force, and what other ways can we get this? I guess it is a problem that we're facing in the fire service and in actually with all first responders, because we all see the same things. Sometimes we're the first ones there, sometimes we're the second base, and sometimes we're the third level. But most of the time, we're all there when these people are having the worst day of their lives.
There's a couple of things that we really need to be doing. Some of them are going to be regulatory in nature. We need to look at getting some type of a psychological wellness program into both the EMT and the medic program, as well as your basic fire programs. In New Jersey, our basic fire program is over 160 hours. And I listen to the griping a lot of, you know, it's too many hours for volunteers. It's too many nights away from your family. You're figuring 3 nights a week, 4 months. And I understand that. But maybe we need to trim back some of the things that we're focusing on that perhaps we don't need to be focusing on so heavily, and actually introduce the concept of wellness as an overall overarching characteristic. We
right.
look at things like firefighter cancer, huge pressing issue in the fire service right now. There's very minimal talk about it at the recruit level, because at the recruit level, we still believe this mindset of, well, my gear is dirty and I earned that dirt. And that shows that, you know, I'm a hard charger, that I've been in fires. Well, no, basically, it shows that you're an idiot at this point, because you know what the damage could be. And I don't know about you, I have 2 kids at home. I don't want to bring that stuff home to them. I come home, my uniform comes off and goes in the wash, and that's the end of it, before I even hug and kiss my own kids, because I don't want to expose them to anything that I've come in contact with at work.
Right.
So if we don't get into a recruit-based program, we're going to have a hard time getting it through the heads of individuals who are still resisting in that dinosaur mentality of the suck-it-up generation, without some type of a regulatory change.
Right.
We need to start looking at things like optimism. My presentations are not self-help presentations. You saw it. This isn't, we're going to sit around in a circle, sing kumbaya, and make s'mores.
Right.
It's just not the way that I am. I'm very much the sharp, pointy stick in the eye type guy. But we need to start focusing on the positive aspects of the job, as opposed to constantly the negative. I was lecturing down in Firehouse, actually, Expo in 2016. One of the questions that I asked my group was, you know, you call your significant other and they don't immediately answer the phone. What's the first thought that comes to your mind? And overwhelmingly, the hand shot up and it was, she's cheating.
Oh, my God.
So I'm kind of floored. From a psychological perspective, I'm like, I've heard this answer before. So I go, well, let me break this down. Why? So how many of you had previous incidents with this? And a couple of the hands went up, but not many. It's like, then why did the rest of you immediately think that? They're like, well, it's just the first thought that came to your mind. Well, how many of you have kids? Okay, a bunch of you. Great. Is it possible that your spouse or your significant other was taking care of your kids? Like mine, if I call my wife and she doesn't answer the phone, chances are high my youngest daughter, who's 2, stole the phone from her and is currently playing with it. So to me, it's a non-existent thing.
Right.
I don't worry about it. But our brains are conditioned and we're focusing on the negative stuff. It's actually called automatic negative thoughts in the psych realm. Our brain goes to the first negative thought, the worst case scenario possible, and then we dwell on stuff like that. So we actually need to start thinking about better alternatives and better approaches to this. How can we be more flexible? How can we be more accurate? How can we be more thorough? It's actually called fat thinking, flexible, accurate, thorough thinking, to be able to get a more positive mindset that'll help us get through the day, help us be a little bit grittier. Dr. Angela Duckworth wrote a great book on the concept of grit, and it's basically resilience and how do we get through the harder adversities in life. She did a lot of her work with the U.S. Military Academy at West Point to figure out which cadets would be most successful. And remarkably, it wasn't the ones that were the PT studs. It wasn't the ones that were the academically inclined students who had the 4.0s coming in. It was the ones that just had a never give up, never quit mentality, which is what we start to see in most of our special operations forces. You want the guys that aren't going to quit, because unfortunately, especially in the fire service, when you're in the middle of an inferno, there's no time to go like, hey, boss, I quit. This isn't for me.
Right.
Because you're not the only one that's going to get hurt. Everybody else is going to die, too.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I've mentioned this a couple of times with other guests. When I went to my first working house fire, and I was in the jump seat on the driver's side, and the captain said, okay, Steve, you're going to be on the nozzle on this one. And we could see the loom up from, we're just up the street from the firehouse. It was about a mile up the street. You could see the loom up as we were heading up there. And I said to the guy in the jump seat next to me, I said, okay, you back me up, you'll be on the hose, and, you know, just hump into me, push it into me, and we'll be fine. We're going to do really well. And we get off. I pull the line. He pulls the extra links, straightens it out. I get up there to the nozzle, and the captain's up there waiting, and my focus is just right on that door that we're going to be going into in the laundry room where the fire was. And I turn around to tell the guy who's in the jump seat with me, all right, we're ready to go. And I see somebody else there. And at that same moment, the captain taps me on the shoulder to go. So we went in, we opened up the nozzle, we knocked it down and stuff like that. Okay, came out and cleaned up, did the overhaul. And I asked the captain, I went back over to the engine and I asked the captain what happened to so-and-so. He was in the jump seat. He was right behind me when we were coming off and grabbing the hose. And he said, the chief had him do something else. So it seemed kind of strange to me. And when we got back to the barn, I asked the chief about it. And he said to me, he said, Stephen, he was not comfortable being that close to going into real fire. So I found another job for him on the fire ground. He helped us with ladders. He'll bring them and help study the ladders when the guys went up on the roof. And that's going to be really good for him. He's going to be very good there. And I suddenly realized what happened. I mean, this guy was actually afraid of going in. That he was also, you know, a rookie as I was, and he was afraid of going in. And instead of the officer or the chief, you know, throwing him out and say, you're not a good guy for this department, they found another place for him. And he, from that moment on, he was very, very active. He was anything that manpower was needed, whether it was one of the social engagements or, you know, any sort of a call. And he was one of the guys who had, you know, usually in the top 10, 12 of responses. And I thought then, how amazing that this chief and this officer in this small department could think that far ahead to take care of somebody with a problem like this. And make sure that they made it an inclusive for him rather than an exclusive and throwing him out. And that was way back then. Don't we have a lot of people still doing that the old way today?
Oh, absolutely. My first or second shift on the job when I went to the fire department, I had a lieutenant, well, it wasn't even a lieutenant at the time, he was an acting officer. We're assigned to an aerial company, and he goes, climb the aerial, and if you don't want to climb the aerial, you're going home. So if you had a fear of heights, you were literally being sent home. And I was like, well, this is a very interesting mindset to have. But okay, whatever. I don't have a problem with the heights. I'll climb the aerial. It is what it is. But it's that same, the lack of progression in some places, as opposed to what you're demonstrating, which is that progressive leadership, that progressive mindset. You know what? Maybe that guy moves on to become one of the best driver operators that there is, and he doesn't want to advance any further.
Right.
We have some great firefighters out there who have no ambition in the world to move to a supervision level, but they're just hard charging, kick in the door, aggressive firemen. And that is, we need all of those types of personalities.
Mm-hmm.
We need the people who are willing to do every job, and they don't constantly have to be the quarterback. They don't have to be the star of the show.
Right. Because that ego isn't there.
No, and there really is no place for ego in the fire service.
That
we see it way too often. You mentioned social media. You see the social media stars who always have comments. You see the what we like to call the safety police, where it's like, oh, his chin strap wasn't, you know, it wasn't fastened properly, or he wasn't wearing this. Like, dude, you weren't there. I've been asked to comment several times about, you know, what do you think of this picture? I think the picture is a split second in time, and I don't know what happened 10 seconds before and 10 seconds after.
Right.
So who am I to comment? I wasn't there.
Right. But we're always, like you mentioned, we're just too fast to shoot from the hip and not think about what's to be said first. And then, of course, once, especially with social media, once the fingers have tapped on the keyboard, it's too late to take it back.
Correct.
And you have
and
to live
in
the with
service,
it.
Unfortunately, we kill and eat our own. We're very good at dressing down people and abusing them and critiquing them, but we're not very good at providing constructive criticism and making them better. Somebody makes a mistake, fine, it's a mistake. We've all done it before. Lord knows I've made more than my fair share, but it's been corrected, and I made sure that I was never going to do that same behavior again. But if we never correct that behavior and it's just constantly, you screwed up, stop screwing up, we'll show them what they've done wrong then. Let's build up our fire service. Let's build up our responders so we can keep them bettering themselves, as opposed to going, I hate coming to work, I don't want to be here anymore, especially on the volunteer side. If you're going to do that to somebody and they decide, hey, I don't want to be here anymore, well, guess what? You just lost a man. And I don't know very many volunteer departments out there that have waiting lists or have lines around the block to join.
I was just about to say the same thing, that we know that today, most volunteer departments, not all, but most volunteer departments across the country are having problems with staffing. Especially daytime staffing. They have a lot of people maybe available at night, but the whole society has changed even since my time in a combination apartment. My time, I had initially we had no children. It was just my wife and myself. I worked a lot of hours at my job, about 60 hours a week, but I still made time for the fire service and did what I could. But today, with so many families with kids, both parents working at least one job, if not one of them, and maybe both of them working two jobs and taking care of the kids and all the after school activities and music lessons and dance, etc., it's very difficult for them to find the time to contribute and donate to a volunteer organization, not just the fire service, but many volunteer organizations are having trouble now getting people. And part of the reason is exactly what you said. Some people go there, and even though they're new and they get this warm, huggy welcome at the beginning, as soon as they do something that does not follow the proposed track, all of a sudden someone says, you shouldn't have done that. That's the wrong thing to do. How could you do that without talking to somebody? And like you said, they stop. They just berate them and stop there. And don't try to teach them, you know what, next time if you face this, let's look at it this way and do it. Here's a way you can do it and get it done really easily without any problems at all. But we're too fast to berate, and then we take the chance of losing that volunteer. And then how long do we have to wait just to fill that position one more time?
Absolutely. And we go right back to those automatic negative thoughts, and we're not looking at the build up and actually keeping that employee or keeping that volunteer. Even the Army had to look at that. They have a comprehensive soldier fitness program that came out of the University of Pennsylvania. It's the Army Master Resilience Trainer Program. And it was designed to teach NCOs how to better develop those under their command. It's a 10-day class to train the trainer. Basically, it's 5 days of actually learning the skills for yourself and then 5 days of actually dealing with it. I was lucky enough to speak to a drill sergeant who was involved in this program, and he goes, I got to tell you a story. And I was like, yeah, sure. I have permission to reuse this story. I don't use any names. And he goes, everybody used to annoy me. One of these, you know, typical type A personality driven, everything is my way. You must follow my rules. He goes, and every time my son would do something wrong, I would yell at him. He goes, and that's just the way, I guess it's the way he was brought up. It's the way he brought up his son. So his son had made a mistake, and his son calls him, and his dad goes, that's okay. You know, we'll address it. We'll work on it later. And his son actually called him on the phone, hey, Dad, are you feeling okay? And he's like, yeah, why? And he goes, you didn't yell at me. And the drill sergeant looks and goes, you know what? You're absolutely right. I didn't. And he goes, it wasn't worth yelling about. So here is somebody whose pretty much mission focus is to yell and get compliance because they're training you to survive in the real world, who this class allowed him to change his entire mindset. I was like, wow, I absolutely have to reuse your story. It builds on the fact that we can change the mindset of individuals. We can allow those individuals to actually focus in a more positive light. And if we can get more of that progression out there, we can make the fire service more welcoming. Now, before we go any further, the whole concept of the fire service being more welcoming, I'm not talking about the political correctness world. Once again, I'm not talking about hand-holding. It is a paramilitary organization. It is a uniformed service. We expect you to follow orders. That's fine. I have zero issue with that. It's those soft skills and those affective domain skills that we can work on a little bit more while still maintaining that discipline and that order and that uniformity. I'll get you to know about that.
That's a great point. That's a great point to make. And I think that, you know, we're at that point today where we've seen now that we desperately need to do this. It needs to be put into the fire service. We have great people who dedicate their lives, and whether their career, volunteer, paid on call, and whether it's the fire service, whether it's EMS or law enforcement, the people who are first responders dedicate their lives to help other people. And the very least we should be doing for the people who make that type of commitment and dedication is provide them with the best atmosphere and community that they for them to operate in.
To keep, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, keep them healthy. Okay, we're going to take a break. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say you need that support. You need that environment. So you're 100% on par.
Right. So that's what we need to try to address. And we're going to take a break here with David, and we'll be right back. We're going to continue talking about resilience and some of the other issues that the fire service is facing and ways that we can address them in a positive manner. Again, we're not shooting from the hip to castigate anybody. All this is about is helping people in a positive manner, whether they're fire, law enforcement, or EMS, makes no difference. These are all important people who serve their communities. We owe them to give them the best environment and community to operate in. So we'll be right back right after these words. Stay tuned. When you're done knocking down the flames, you want to hit the apparatus and head back to the barn, right? Wrong. If you do, you're carrying all types of poisons and carcinogens with you and spreading them wherever you go. But you can clean your gear and yourself before you even leave the scene with a Fireground Decon Kit from the folks at FireTech. This kit contains everything you need to properly and safely decontaminate yourself while still on the scene. This kit includes a pop-up pod for a private changing room, exclusive Fireground Decon hose designed to reduce contamination, all-natural decon towels, a special PPE cleaner formulated to remove stubborn hydrocarbons and that meets NFPA 1851 standard, and more. With a cancer rate among firefighters at 60% against only 20% among the general population, we can no longer ignore the dangers we can't see. For more information, visit their website at www.firegrounddeconstore.com or call FireTech at 954-906-1118. You're listening to Five Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. The tones sound and the dispatcher announces, stations 14 and 16, working residential structure. That was all you needed to hear. You jump up from your chair, head to the engine, and climb into the jump seat. As the cue screams, you take stock of your PPE, bunker pants, check, turnout coat, check, hood, check, gloves, check, escape line, check, SCBA strapped on, you're ready. Upon arrival, you jump off the apparatus, grab the loops of the red cross lay, and head for the open front door where smoke is pouring out. You make sure your buddy's behind you. You crouch low and make your way inside, your trusty SCBA mask hanging on your tool belt. What? Stop everything. What the hell are you thinking? You see it's a working room and contents fire, and the smoke is banking down almost to the floor. Who do you think you are, Superman? One breath of that crap and the smoke will damage you in some way, guaranteed. All the soot, carbon, carcinogens, and other outgassing materials will enter your body through the pores on your unprotected face. Don't be the domino, the first person down, that forces everyone else to change their tasks to take care of you. Always remember, face peace on. You have comrades depending on you and a family to go home to. Face peace on. And we're back with Five Alarm Task Force news and issues for today's first responders with our guest, David Wiklansky, who is a firefighter EMT, but he also has an MA in psychology, behavioral sciences, human behavior. And we're talking about resilience and the whole behavioral health attitude and issues in the fire service. And David, we were at the very end of our first segment, we were talking about the need to broaden the horizons to get these messages out and to attract more listeners so that we can help them do their job in a more positive atmosphere that they can take home with them rather than the burdens that they often take home with them today.
Absolutely. Again, I have to say thank you for just bringing this topic to the forefront. We all understand that behavioral health and mental health in particular isn't as sexy as hose lines and Halligans, but it's definitely one of these things that has to be discussed.
Right.
We have to start preparing our members for it. One of the things that I do is I'm an advocate for the Everyone Goes Home program for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. The NFFF actually has a program called Stress First Aid for Fire and EMS. It's 4 hours. There's a 90-minute online version. But it's free, so it fits into everyone's budget, because we understand that in budgetary constraints, the first thing that usually goes is training. Lately, our team has been out. We have another class coming up on the 25th that we're going to be doing for an agency. And it's amazing to watch the light bulbs go off in some people's heads when they hear the message of, you know, we understand that you want to help. Most people, by our inherent nature of being in this field, want to help. And we're more than willing to help others do whatever it is that they need to do. I was moving recently. I bought a house last year. I had a bunch of guys from my shift like, hey, let us know. We'll come out and we'll give you a hand. You know, in the fire service, you need a ride somewhere. You need a ride home. Maybe, like we were talking about earlier, you went out to the bar. You don't want to drive, which is a smart move. Somebody gives you a ride home. Unfortunately, we're not at the point yet where if you walk up to somebody and go, hey, I'm having a really hard time, and I was thinking that my gun looks awfully appetizing right now, and I'm not sure that I want to live in this world anymore, most people aren't sure how to help you. So we're trying to bring those resources out to people, because I'm sure they want to help. I don't think that people are necessarily aware of how to be able to help. One of the things that the SFA course addresses is that mindset and that framework of, here's how we're going to help you to get to the help that you need. It's not designed for clinicians. It's designed for rank and file firefighters. It's designed to get people thinking about, I can help you. I don't expect anybody to go to school and get a master's or a doctorate in psychology to be able to help. But I do expect that somebody could look and go, hey, you know what? You're generally a really happy person. And today at work, you're miserable, you're grumpy, you're mopey. So what can I do? Like, are you okay? Let's take a walk outside. I'm known for my coffee break sessions. I'll grab a cup of coffee. They'll grab a cigarette. And we'll just sit there and BS for a while as to what's going on in life.
Sure.
And maybe I can help you and maybe I can't. And if I can't, I'm probably sure that I can find you somebody who can. On my website, I have a whole bunch of resources, not only national, but also New Jersey specific. So depending on what type of insurance you have, we can find you somebody. Your employee assistance program can probably find you someone.
Mm-hmm.
So there are resources out here that we can get to you to be able to help you deal with the stress and the anxiety. Because what we're seeing is that we're bringing it home. I know I'm that way. I come home from a long day at work. And I walk through the door, I have an hour commute home, not really that bad. Usually that hour commute home is my decompression time. But there are some days where I get home and I just look at my wife and I'm like, listen, I know it's going to be rough because you've had the kids for the entire 24 that I've been at work, but I need an hour. I need to just go sit in my office or lay down in bed and close my eyes, and I need to decompress, because if not, I'm going to not be the father and the husband that I need to be, because I need that time. But I also recognize that in myself. Whereas other people don't oftentimes recognize, like, hey, I'm heavily stressed out. I'm taking it out of my wife and kids, and I don't know why I'm stressed. Well, chances are high you're stressed as a result of the job.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I'm, as you were saying that, I was seeing my younger self back in 1985, when I had my brother and I had just started a business venture together, and my dad was so excited for us because he said he'd always want to try and do that, and he was afraid to do it because he was afraid it would fail and he wouldn't be able to support our family. And then shortly, just before we started it, he passed away. And I took it very hard. I have two brothers, one older, one younger. And I had a really, really tough time with it. And I was, to put it plainly, I was an asshole. That's what I became. I ran my store, and I was still a member of the fire service. I did everything there. Matter of fact, I used the fire service to let off a lot of the built-up pressures in me when I went on a lot of these calls. But that's the way I was. And it got to the point where, my wife and I had words about it. And what you said is exactly what I just saw myself. In as you described it, I just saw myself in my mind's eye. And back in those days, coming into the house, and she's holding one of the kids in her arms, and she's holding our older daughter by the hand. And she takes one look at me, and she knows, not to say anything. And I just go down to the basement to my office. And that's exactly the way I was, because there was nobody to handle. And even though I'm the one who did it for everybody else because of my work at the synagogue, just for those at that one for 3 years prior, there was nobody who offered me any help, who came to me. I finally found a better path several months later, but it wasn't through a traditional source. We'll just put it that way. If it was true for me, and I'm not too haughty or proud to admit that I did that, then there are thousands of us who are doing the same thing still today. And we just need to break that. And you're absolutely right. Continue.
Listening to this conversation, or when this airs, they're going to listen to this conversation going, holy S, that's me.
Yeah.
And a lot of us, we know when we're changing. We know when that behavior is changing, but we don't oftentimes see it or recognize it. I know one of my things is I'm not a very impulsive person. I'm the kind of guy that I'd be like, oh, I want to spend $100 on something. So I'll research it for like 6 months. I'll make sure that whatever it is the exact same thing that I want. I'll look for the cheapest price that I could possibly get. And eventually I drive my wife crazy, and she's like, just buy it, especially if it's business related. She's like, just buy the damn thing. I'm tired of listening to you talk about it. So when I see myself making impulsive, usually interpersonal decisions that are going to destroy relationships, so like ending friendships all of a sudden, I don't always catch it until somebody goes like, wow, Dave, you're being really impulsive. And as soon as I hear the word impulsive, like the little switch goes off in my head, and I'm like, oh, crap. Something's up. Something's definitely wrong in my life, because here is this behavioral change. And listen, I'm trained to see that. But unfortunately, like you were saying, when you're one of the helpers, you're so willing to help everyone else that you don't oftentimes spend the time on yourself.
Right.
But we can't pour from an empty cup. And if we can't pour from an empty cup, we need to be taking care of ourselves. It's not selfish. It's allowed. In fact, I'm one of these guys that, and I'm probably going to get a lot of flack for saying this, if you need to take a sick day for mental health reasons, like you're so far burnt out, I'm okay with that. You run a job, you go on a fatality, you end up having to do CPR on a child, you need a couple of days off, I'm okay with that too. Because I want you to be well. I want you to be able to process it. But I don't want you just taking the days off just to sit around and mope. I want you taking the days off to go talk to somebody. It's okay to seek professional counseling. I used to see a psychologist on a regular basis. I actually do almost like a yearly checkup. We do physical checkups, and we go for our medical clearances.
Mm-hmm.
We have a program in New Jersey called the Captain Busio Program. It's free. It's like $50,000 worth of testing, and it's probably the most comprehensive medical testing that you can go through at our level. So we do that, but yet we don't worry about psychological health and fitness. So about every year, I contact a psychologist that I know, and I'm like, hey, I want to come in. I want to set up an appointment and basically just do a checkup. Let's see how I'm doing. Are the coping skills that I'm using working? Basically, do I need to change something? Do you have any suggestions? And just like going to see your doctor on a regular basis, go see a psychologist. It's okay to decompress to somebody else.
That's a great idea. I've never even thought of it, but it makes perfect sense. It really does. I mean, we're every 2 seconds on television, go see a doctor for your annual checkup. And we're doing it, as part of the health and wellness initiative for the firefighters. Make sure you get, your health and wellness checkup, and make sure that you have fitness for duty. We don't need you to be an Adonis, and going in Mr. Universe contest. We're talking about fit for duty. And yet
Absolutely.
We don't include, for whatever reason, we don't include your psychological wellness as part of that initiative, which we really should be doing.
Absolutely. When we're looking at the numbers, and you had Jeff Dill on, so obviously he talked about the suicide stats and how the estimate is 30-40%
right.
of what's actually occurring is what's being reported. I want to say in 2017 we had 99, which actually exceeds our line of duty death rate. We've actually exceeded our line of duty death rate every year except for, I think it was 2013. We didn't come close to it. But if we're losing more providers to their own hand and they're dying by suicide than we are to the job, we need to be addressing these issues. And maybe we need to have a program where it's like, hey, you know what? Let's eliminate the stigma. Because one of the biggest problems we understand about mental health is stigma. You mentioned that you have a mental health injury. People walk away from you like you have leprosy.
Right.
They don't want to be anywhere near you. You're crazy. You're this. You're that. You know what? You're unstable. But yet you get a guy who's like, I want to go for help. Maybe we need to start doing mandatory meetings with a psychologist. Maybe it's monthly. Maybe it's quarterly. Because at this point, I can eliminate the stigma. Hey, Steve, you know, we know that you have this appointment with the psychologist. What'd you talk to them about? Oh, man, we talked about football. We talked about baseball. We talked about – it doesn't matter what you talked about because it was mandatory that you be there. So you could have decompressed with that shrink about absolutely everything in the world that's going on in your life, yet nobody has to know.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's not, why did you go see a psychologist? Oh, you know, the boss makes it mandatory. Yes, it costs money. An hour per guy, we have a roughly 100-man department, 100 man hours. It gets expensive. But how much is it going to cost to replace a guy who's been there 5, 6, 7, 10, 20 years?
Right.
I was talking to a good friend of mine, Ben Vernon from San Diego. It's one of the things that he was talking about was that, you know, the stigma associated with mental health after he got injured in the line of duty was just like, guys were like, we don't really know how to deal with you. But he had a guy on his shift that, you know, the typical, like, man mountain, the guy's physically jacked. He's like this imposing specimen of a human being. And he goes, yeah, I go and I see a therapist, and I go and I do this, and I go and do this. You know, it keeps me centered. And Ben's like, so here's this guy that everybody looks up to, the quintessential senior man in the department, who's like, yeah, why doesn't everybody do this? So we almost perceive that there's a stigma, and there is, but we need to be able to work on eliminating it. We need to work on fostering that communication and actually talking about it. The only way we get over things like stigmas is to actually bring it out into the light and go, hey, you know what? I have a mental health disorder. I need help for it. You're with me or you're against me. We preach and we talk about a brotherhood, which sadly in today's day and age, I'm not sure still exists. I know there are some times and there are some people out there that espouse it. One of those guys is Mark Alone. He's a good friend of mine from Columbia County, Georgia. Great dude. And he talks about brotherhood. He speaks on it. He understands it. Then there's other guys that it's, what can you do for me? And we have that mentality in our system where it's a, what can you do for me? And not so much, hey, you're my brother and I'm here to look out for you.
Right. Right. Well, that's, we see, again, social media allows people to, number one, hide behind their IDs. On many versions of social media. And so they say whatever they want to say. It's not until after it's too late and something terrible happens that we find out that, you know, there were hints all along that there were problems and that those should have been addressed. But I think what I think we really need, and I'm going back to the conference where you and I met, is to have people like you and people like Mark Lamplug and some of the other specialists who really address this issue follow suit to leader our other great instructors like Dan Kerrigan and instructor John Dixon when they like to say, I'm going to throw a grenade into the room about and talk about something that, you know, normally isn't talked about. And Dan started his class at the school that way. And instructor John did it that way as well. And we need more people with like you getting that message out. And again, not being put in that room far down the corner at the conference hall, rather putting you in a main room with 1,200 seats So you can say the same thing there and get that, roll that grenade down the room and let everybody hear how important this message is. And that's what we have to break through, is that we have to find these organizations that put on these regional conferences and national conferences to have, and they're beginning to, because I know, as you just said, you were there at Expo in 2016, the first Expo in Nashville. And, you know, it's beginning now. And the very fact that Chief Sendelbach talked about that issue at the very beginning of our podcast, that those articles 4-1 are all about behavioral health, shows that at least right now, we know Firehouse, and I know from reading Fire Engineering, now both of them are really pushing these issues of behavioral health now. And because of their readership and their following, hopefully they can be the instigators in a good way of getting more of the messages that you're delivering, and Mark and others like you, about behavioral health and how it affects us in the fire service, whether we wish to admit it or not.
I agree with that. We're seeing that change, and thankfully Firehouse and Fire Engineering are at the forefront of actually pushing that change. Not that long ago, a week or two ago, I got a rejection letter for a conference. Not a big deal. I'm used to it. But it was mental health or behavioral health isn't a hot enough or a pressing enough topic for us to bring you in. And I'm literally staring at this email, like, vibrating violently. So it's like, how is this not a pressing enough topic? And we can name the high-profile suicides. You talked about things where you have the bullying and the online cyberbullying. In Virginia, you had Nicole Mittendorf, where she was harassed unrelentingly until she made the decision that she did.
Right.
And she took her own life as a result. Because people don't know how to behave, and we lose that ability to be human beings, and we lose compassion and kindness anymore. I understand the world's a difficult place, and it's getting worse. Hopefully it'll start to get better. But we're seeing the worst in humanity, but we can't fall prey to that mentality. We need to keep that humanity side, especially in us. We're the helpers. We're the healers. We need to be the human beings. We shouldn't be the ones that are pushing people who we claim to be our brothers and our sisters to the breaking point.
Right, and the fact that they rejected you with that reason indicates that they're really not aware of the reality of...
It's the dinosaur mindset.
Yeah.
I just call it the dinosaur mindset because it makes the most sense.
Right.
I know when I was at Firehouse, I was speaking to a chief from Long Island. I won't mention the department, but hey, chief, if you're out there listening, my offer still stands. I'll come out and I'll lecture your department. He asked me what I was lecturing on, so I told him, and he goes, you don't need to know any of that stuff. You should just suck it up. And I'm like, I just sit there and I look at him and I blink a couple of times and I hand him my business card. I'm like, listen, Long Island's not that far of a drive for me. I was like, give me a call. I'll come out and I'll lecture for you guys. Because obviously we have this mindset that we shouldn't be talking about this because it's not a problem. Well, obviously it's a problem. Our statistics show it. And not even just so much the suicide stats. When we get into things like absenteeism, we get into things like substance abuse issues.
Right.
How many firefighters and medics are we sending to not only counseling, but to rehab centers,
right,
in an effort to control their addiction that they more than likely developed either as a result of an on-the-job injury or on-the-job stressors?
Yeah, but I mean, that's it. And you know what? It's kind of surprising. This that kind of struck me that I would have expected that kind of response from maybe somebody in a small community in the Midwest or the Deep South or something like that. But from a department in Long Island, it really is that dinosaur mindset. Because it's just, you know, the worst thing I can think can happen is that a department who refuses to address these issues loses somebody. And when the dust settles and they find out the history of what led up to this, and they see that it was, like you just said, on-the-job stressors of some kind that drove this firefighter to make the decision that he or she did. How do they make up for that? How do they that night, after they find out that the problem was right there in front of them and they didn't do anything, how do they sleep? How do they go to sleep that night?
I have no idea.
You know, if they're not.
Having talked to a bunch of places, they don't tend to handle it very well. There was a department in the South that had a member commit suicide, and the way of handling that, or their way of grieving, was their chief ordered that if you were to go to the funeral, no Class A uniforms, no dress uniforms whatsoever, no honor for this fallen brother who died by suicide, because we don't want to address it. Well, wrong approach, because unfortunately we know that funerals are more for the living than for the dead.
Right.
It's to allow the bereaved to grieve properly. And if they felt that they needed to honor their brother that way, well, maybe that should have been the approach. But unfortunately, that wasn't, at least in this particular case, that wasn't the mindset that was addressed.
That's a shame. And it not only is it a shame, but it's an embarrassment. It's a smudge on the face of the fire service. It really is.
Yes.
It really is. We cannot.
If we don't know how to deal with it.
Right.
If we don't know how to deal with something, seek somebody who does. If you're not sure how to answer, that's what we all learn in the fire service, right? Nobody came into the fire service as an expert on anything. We went to training, we learned, we had instructors, we had academies, we even had tailboard type training. I learned some of the very best knowledge that I could ever have acquired, literally sitting at the feet of two of the most senior guys in my old volunteer house. 50 plus years apiece, total of 100 and something years of experience between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, hey kid, let me teach you this. Absolutely. But you have to be willing to ask those questions. And we see a lot that in upper management level positions, asking for help is frowned upon, just like it is in mental health. If we ask for help, it is frowned upon. We need to change that entire mindset. Because if I'm a chief officer and I don't know how to do something, I would rather go, hey, who is my expert? How do I utilize my experts to figure out the answer to this problem versus just trying to figure it out and maybe making that misstep or making the wrong decision as a result?
Right, and without even thinking about what are the ramifications of the wrong decision.
Yeah. Like your morale goes absolutely to hell because now everybody's upset with you because you wouldn't allow them to honor their brothers.
Right, and now you have, instead of you have the one person who took his or her own life, now you have a department full of people who are angry, upset, losing focus, losing their desire to be an integral part because they don't know, they're caught in betwixt and between of losing this close friend and a department that says you can't honor their service in the department just because they took their own life, even if you don't even know the reason why.
Most of us are willing to take calculated risks if we know that the department has our back. In that particular instance, when you lose that feeling of, hey, my department will support you, how much more work are you willing to do? How many more risks are you willing to take? And unfortunately, when you start to break down that bond and you break down that agreeableness, we start to run into a lot more problems.
Sure.
Because now your manpower pool is dejected. They don't want to be there. Your absentee rates go through the roof. There's a lot of things that tie into mental health other than just what we think about. When we think about PTSD, we think about suicide, we think about drug and alcohol abuse. You have things like depression. You have things like burnout. You have absenteeism. These things are all financial because if that member's absent and I have mandatory overtime, now it's costing me money to put somebody else on there.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can invest in a wellness program and I can keep my people physically strong, together, know, mentally put together, keep them de-stressed as much as possible, well, maybe I don't generate as much overtime. Maybe I don't have as big of a bill. EAP programs work, depending on which one you end up choosing. There's a bunch of different types, and there's a free model that most cities use, and unfortunately the free model is not always the best. But we'll get there eventually.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a start, right?
Yeah.
If it's a free, if they take advantage of it, at least it's the first step.
It gets somebody through your door, and then you could refer them out to somebody who's more adequately prepared.
Right, right.
And on that side, we also have to have clinicians who are prepared to handle us. I had done a survey about a year ago It was, what do you think is one of the biggest barriers of getting the help that we need? And almost overwhelmingly, it was the clinicians don't understand us. They're either not from the fire service. They have no knowledge of emergency services at all. They're trained in trauma. They're trained in PTSD, or they're trained to work with a specific discipline like the military. They don't necessarily understand the fire service. They don't understand the culture that we come from, the laughing and the joking and the breaking bread with everybody. You almost need these clinicians to be in the firehouse with you, sit down to dinner with you, come out to breakfast with you, do ride-alongs with you. Dr. Tanya Glenn actually just put out a good book on first responder resilience. It's available on Amazon. Take a look at it. It's great for somebody who is not clinically minded to understand what resilience is all about. It's about 170 pages. I couldn't put it down. It's a fantastic book. It's a great read. But it addresses those things such as getting your clinicians out there so that way we make those face-to-face contacts. In Louisiana, pre-Katrina, Louisiana State University Health Sciences Center used to match their clinicians up with their resources. So they would go out to firehouses, they would go out to the ambulances, and they would go out to the cops, and they would put faces to names. So after Katrina hit, everybody was co-located on giant cruise ships. It was really easy. It's not, hey, Steve, come to my office and we'll talk. It's, hey, let's walk outside. I'm having a cigarette. Hey, you're having a cigarette at the same time. You know, how are you doing? It's those five-minute informal, they're called high-quality connections. We actually spend time dealing with one another instead of listening for the intent of responding. We listen for the intent of understanding the information. Because as human beings, we are conditioned to just listen with the intent of responding. Absolutely no point in time do we sit here and go, let me listen to what they're saying for their feelings. Let me listen to hear for what they're understanding. Someone starts speaking and we go, how am I going to answer this next question that they're asking me?
Wow. That's a very interesting point to bring up. I never looked at it that way. So how do we get people to change that way of when they sit and talk with somebody so that they will be open up to exchange rather than worry about the answers?
There's a concept called active constructive responding. It's pretty much the one we need to be aware of. There's also active destructive, passive constructive, and destructive. Easiest way to think about it is active constructive is actual like enthusiastic support, like you're happy for people.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen it happen in places that I've worked before. Guy comes in and he's like, hey, I'm having a baby. Well, for most people, when you announce that amongst the brotherhood, it should be, hey, congratulations, that's awesome, you're going to be a great dad. That would be active constructive. Unfortunately, what we see is, oh my God, do you know how expensive, you know, kids are going to be? Are you sure it's yours? Like the normal laughing and the bantering that we do, we don't necessarily think about the effect of it.
Right.
Actually can not really disregard, but can actually knock somebody down. Because here you are sharing great news about your life, and the responses that you're getting are not overwhelmingly good. So then in that case, why would I share the remainder of my life with you? Why would I try and build that connection? And we get these connections where we stop and we listen to somebody to go out on vacation. You're like, hey, how was your vacation? And it's not just a passing statement, you know, like you're going to ship change. It's like, hey, man, how was your vacation? Oh, yeah, that's great. And you're walking out the door. But it's like, hey, you know what? How was your vacation? Hey, do you have some pictures? I want to see them. You know, what did you see? Where did you go? What was the best part about it? Did you enjoy it? Did the family enjoy it? Something like that is, hey, you have now taken a positive interest in my life. Therefore, I am willing to share more information with you. And there's going to be bad days. We all have bad days where we snap and we bite somebody's head off.
Right.
And that type of rapport, if that's all somebody knows, they're never going to trust you. If you've always been good with them and you've worked and you've created essentially a bank of these high-quality connections, when you have that bad day and you snap somebody's head off, guess what? Dave's having a bad day. He's normally not like this. As opposed to, wow, like you mentioned before, when you were coming home and you were just off.
Right.
We all have those days where it's kind of deposits and withdrawals. We're making more withdrawals than deposit. We're overdrawn. And when we're overdrawn, people start to look and go, well, are they overdrawn because they really aren't that nice of a person?
That's a good point. That's a very easy way of looking at it, too. The difference between withdrawal and deposits. If we don't have enough deposits in there, we can't cover the bill when it comes due. And that can have a very nasty effect when we can't. All right, we're going to take.
I have a favorite expression.
Go ahead.
Sorry,
that's okay.
I have a favorite expression. I like to break things down Barney style, because all I ever get to watch on TV anymore is children's programming because of my kids. But there's some life lessons that could be learned from children's programming.
Okay. Oh, I thought you were going to tell me from. Oh, so Barney style. Okay, that's great. That is cute. So how old are the both kids? One is two. I know you said. What was the other one? That's great.
I got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Wonderful. That's great. Okay, we're going to be back with David, and we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the positive sides we can look at when we come back. We'll be right back right after these words with our guest, David Wiklansky. Please stay tuned. No matter where we live, or no matter the season, there is always work to be done that makes us sweat. Just how can we keep cool? Well, Hennessy Distributing has the answer. Cool towels. Cool towels are 100% cotton towel and pre-moistened with all natural ingredients. The best part? No water is needed. Just open your cool towel pack, remove the towel and give it a couple of shakes, and you're all set. Wrap it around your neck like a kerchief, wipe your face, arms, neck, or any exposed skin, and it is approximately 20 to 30 degrees below the ambient temperature. Wait, did it warm up? No problem. Just shake it a couple of times again, and cool towel delivers its refreshing cool touch all over again. When the cooling mixture has expired, use your cool towel as you would any cloth or rag around the house. Because it is manufactured from 100% cotton, your cool towel is 100% recyclable. For more information or to get your cool towel today, visit www.cooltowel.com or call 1-800-918-8323. Remember, you're going to work and you're going to sweat. Make cool towel your answer to keeping cool. Cancer. Ugh. Nobody likes to hear that word. However, as firefighters, that word sure likes us. Here are a couple of facts. 1. Did you know that among average adults in the U.S., the cancer rate is approximately 20% in a given year? The rate for us? Over 60%. Number 2. When you don't wear your full PPE, especially during overhaul, due to the heat and sweat, your uncovered skin pores are wide open, and all those carcinogens in the soot and smoke love to dive right in. Number 3. Not only is the rate of cancer higher in firefighters, but we get all types of weird forms of cancer. Number 4. When you don't clean or change your PPE and your uniform and you don't decon or grab a strong shower afterward, you're dragging all that cancer crap with you everywhere you go. The bays, the day room, your vehicle, even your home. Listen, our job is tough enough, and we have enough to worry about. Don't let cancer get in your way. Talk to your officers and your chief, your fire surgeon, or your personal physician. Learn what you can do to reduce your chances of dealing with a firefighter-relating cancer. Beat cancer before it beats you. And we're back with the third segment of this episode of Five Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. And our guest is David Wiklansky, a New Jersey firefighter EMT, holds a master's in psychology and behavioral sciences, human behavior. And we've been talking about that and how it affects the fire service. And right now we're going to talk about character and the role that character and character strength can play on both sides of the fire service, the hiring and the individual themselves. So, David, take it away, please.
Absolutely. Thank you. Peter Schutz, the former CEO of Porsche, is credited with having a statement of hire for character and train for skill. We've heard it in the fire service before, where we really need to be looking at the character of the individual that we hire as opposed to whether or not they were, for lack of a better expression, a certificate mill. There are certain departments where you have to have firefighter one, firefighter two, paramedic, driver, operator, et cetera, before they'll even consider you. Well, that's great. It shows that somebody went through a lot of education, and it shows that the individual is motivated to learn. But do they necessarily fit within the culture of your organization? Are they actually the type of person that you want to be hiring? I know during my hiring process, there was a bunch of questions about integrity. Not necessarily was I a problem for integrity, but it was, what is your definition of integrity? What does having integrity mean to you? There's a bunch of the typical scenarios that demonstrate whether or not you're actually going to perform well in that situation. But we have in psychology a concept of character strength, one of the things that I lecture on, and it's just positive traits, and it's things for it's things that we have for thinking and feeling and behaving, and how we're going to react to situations on almost a subconscious level. And do we actually have the capacity to demonstrate these things on a regular basis? So if we're looking at the ability to hire for character, like Google does and a bunch of other the major corporations, do we have the right hiring process? Are we really vetting people from the psych standpoint? I know that the psych process that we went through was, you know, draw the house, the train, the person, take the MMPI, take a couple of subjective personality tests, answer a bunch of questions, go through a structured interview, and you either passed or you failed. Well, if you're really somewhat with it, you can tell which questions are the dangerous ones. The questions like, I refuse to work with women because they can't do the job. Well, if you answer yes to that, you have no place in this brotherhood. You really don't even belong in the fire service, if that's honestly your belief. But perhaps we need to be looking more at, can we hire the right types of people? And if we're looking at character strengths, we're also looking at the strengths of resilience. We're looking at the people who are have been proven to be psychologically more stable and don't have the predisposition to trauma. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that if you have a predisposition to trauma that we should disqualify you, but is it really right for us to take someone who has been predisposed to trauma and traumatic stress and put them in an environment that we know is full of traumatic stress? So we are irreparably harming you as a result of these decisions to hire you.
Right.
And my mission is to keep you safe and get you home to your family and make sure that you're put together and you're mentally stable. But am I really doing my best by saying, yes, we understand that you might have a predisposition to this and we're not even going to warn you about the potential stressors? I don't really think it works. So with regard to character strength, there's a quick survey that you could do. It's about 120 questions, and I know that sounds overwhelming, but it only takes about 10 to 15 minutes. I'll send you a link so you can post it on your podcast. But it gives you your top five character strengths. Well, that's interesting, because when we look at the top five reasons why people do what they do, it'll give me a better read on my candidate. Mm-hmm. Then how do we relate those character strengths also to the fire service? We look at things like creativity is one. Well, how do we relate creativity to the fire service? Well, I don't know. Thinking outside the box comes to mind. Because if we have individuals that can think outside the box, they usually come up with the solutions. And we know that the fire service, if we were to sit around the firehouse kitchen table with a pot of coffee, there is nothing in this world that we can't solve the problem for.
Right.
We could figure out everything from global warming to the socioeconomic impact of, well, everything. Because as firefighters, we're just inherent problem solvers. We look at character strengths such as bravery and valor. It's what you think about when you think about the fire service. We go back to movies like Backdraft, which everybody's familiar with, even though we hate to admit to it and it's not really even remotely close to the truth. We think about the valor that is shown by firefighters on a daily basis. So we have to be able to understand, is that in your inherent nature? Are we hiring individuals who they not only lack that, but they lack the general bravery to stand up for what's good and what's right? Are we hiring people for integrity decisions? Are we hiring the people that we necessarily need to bolster and foster the development of the group as a whole?
That's an interesting approach. I found that when I applied to my first department, which it was very interesting. I went to the department. I discovered it a couple of days after we moved into our apartment. It was right down the street, and I was going to a market to pick up a few groceries. And I saw the bay doors open. I saw a shiny red truck, so I walked in to look around. And I met the captain, and he introduced himself and showed me around. And then he said to me, oh, by the way, the chief's here. If you like to, you know, do you have time to just meet him and say hello? And I said, yeah, sure, not a problem. And took me into his office and introduced himself. And the chief said, so you're here to join the fire department. I said, huh? What? What was that? He said, well, the captain says you're here to join up. I said, well, actually, sir, I just came to look at the shiny red trucks. Because have you ever been in the fire service? I said, no. I said, I've done a lot of first aid stuff with Red Cross for many years. He says, well, then you should be a member. Gave me an envelope. He says, just bring this back when it's filled out. And I talked with my wife about it, and neither one of us knew a lot about it other than shiny red trucks and loud sirens and the camaraderie. And I joined, and I met this other guy who was 18-year-old kid, whose parents had dropped him off at the small college there in the community and then left him there to flounder on his own, as it turned out. And he found the fire service. He'd rode with Bethesda Chevy Chase a little bit because he was from Washington area. And we kind of formed a bond and a friendship. And today he's still my best friend, 40 years later, and one of my business partners. But for some reason, the chief saw in us something that he didn't see in the other people. And it might have been, we think, because first of all, we were the first two Jewish people who ever walked into that department and actually applied to join. And he also saw our eagerness to learn. And for our entire time there, we were always selected to go to extra programs. And we went to the State Fire College for 3 summers in a row. We were selected to do that. And I got to see him this past summer. I was back in North Carolina. And I didn't even know he was still around, and thank God he was. And I went to visit him at his home, and we sat down and had a great talk for 2 hours. And he told me that one of the reasons was that he saw in me a young man who had a good faith because of my work in the synagogue, strong faith, and seemed to have a strong background and knew how to dedicate himself. I worked for the Red Cross, and he said, you had the right character that I wanted to mold. And that's why I let you learn, and had you go and selected you and Rich to go to all these conferences and learn this stuff. And I over the years, I've thought back. I was only there for 4 years, but I've always remembered that experience first. And having the opportunity to speak with the chief again this past summer showed me how much that integrity and character counted for him when he made that selection. Now, when I walked into the station, I was wearing part of a suit. I was wearing my suit slacks and a shirt and tie because I'd come from my office. And he just said that, when I made that presence to him dressed like that, he knew he had somebody special. And I lucked out for me. But I can see, with that said, I can see exactly what you're talking about, that if we looked for just bodies to put in the jump seats, we looked for people with character and integrity and a connection to doing good and serving others, that can make a whole difference in the makeup of our departments and how our department functions.
It can go back and address that issue of the environment that we spoke about earlier, where if we're going to change the way that we handle things and we're going to adapt our own culture to better taking care of people as opposed to breaking them down, we need this type of a change. You need those people who have these character strengths. Because really, our character strengths are where we turn when we lose interest, when we lose talent, we lose skills, we lose resources. It's how we cope and adapt. It's almost the core foundation of how we live and what really means the most to us. It's those unshakable beliefs, which is actually really interesting because I don't think most people actually understand what their core beliefs are. We might think we do until we're put in a position where we actually have to make that decision. I recently left a job because they put me in a position where it was an integrity issue. I was told that I had to do something that I wasn't willing to do because it wasn't right. It was the wrong decision. It was an educational spot. And after I voiced my concern, it was, well, then you're no longer welcome here. Okay, fine. So be it. My integrity meant more to me than that job did. And it was an easy call. Other people in that same position would have been like, oh my God, I don't want to lose this job. So let me stay here and let me just sacrifice everything that is that I believe in for a paycheck.
Right.
If that's the way it is, well, perhaps you're not the best candidate. You're not the best person to be here. You mentioned things like being able to learn and going to the state fire college. Love of learning is a character strength. We need individuals, because let's face the reality of the situation, when it's drill time or training night in a volunteer house, most people have some type of thing come up. They're, you know, they have a phone call they still have to take. They have to go to the bathroom. They don't necessarily want to be there. And the guys who are the lifelong learners who are like, let's train, let's do something, usually get berated the most because, well, why are you always the first one in line to do XYZ scale?
Right.
Because it has to get done. We're dealing with a job that can kill us, so we might as well learn from it and be self-directed and go from there. You look at professional development. The National Fire Academy has a professional development symposium coming up in June. Well, I guess I could talk about it now because the agenda just came out. I was selected to speak at it.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's all about professional development. And it's a matter of, as a fire service, the NFA is essentially our version of Harvard. It is where you go to excel. It's not, once again, hoses and hand lines and not hands-on skills, but it's to develop you and develop the leadership that we see in most of the people that we have. So you have the ability to go somewhere and learn from, I'm looking forward to learning from the best of the best.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why I'm going to the conference is so I can actually learn from the individuals that are teaching there.
You know, it was that reminds me that I was one of the things I told Joe DeVito, Captain Joe DeVito, who was the volunteer coordinator for the Great Florida Fire School where you and I met, was that not only did I enjoy doing the work he asked me to do, which was taking the photos of the classes and the videos, but I really loved listening to each one. And I only wish I could have heard the sat in to every single class that was there. Because it brought me back to the time when I was in active service, and you know, I was really appreciate the warm welcome that I received from everybody at the school. And again, I got to thank, you know, Captain Joe for everything he did for me to invite me there and to let me participate. And I just loved that environment that Saturday morning of the classes. And it just was, it just brought me back to my days when I was in the service and I would go to the programs and the classes there to learn. And I felt that way again because we had such great speakers and there was so much to teach and so much to learn. And I just kind of didn't like having to pull all the equipment out myself and go to the next room until I listened to that person and start listening to them and their presentation. So I've come home, and as I put this all together now, almost be done to have the video all set, I get to listen to all of you again. And I'm keeping that part for myself, all the excerpts, the audio excerpts and video that I can learn from what each of you said again and use that as my little classroom one more time. Because I do love to learn, and that's one of the reasons why I went ahead with the podcast is I had this background in audio video for years, and I had not done anything recently, and I didn't know digital methods and stuff. When I worked with it, we used to actually cut a piece of tape and tape it together when we edited. Now I'm doing electronic editing, but I had to sit and learn how to do it, and initially it was an obstacle, and I set a goal to overcome it, and for the most part, I have, and I really enjoy doing it, and I look forward to having the time to opportunity to sit with every guest and talk with them about something that's important to the fire service and first responders. And as I said to you off air, if it's important to the fire service and first responders, then it's important to me, and that means it's important to this podcast to get that information out. And I hope that the people who do listen to this podcast on a regular basis are turning to it not just for entertainment's sake, but to learn from my guests and to pick up something that maybe something they knew a little bit about before and they learn a little bit more now, or something they didn't know about at all and they learn something about it now. And I think that if my guests and I can bring that to the listeners, then we're accomplishing part of that goal that we've set for ourselves, because I see myself still as a teacher by bringing these podcasts out and having guests like you and Captain Joe and Chief Sandelbach and Bobby Halton. And I even had our late great Chief Bruno on with, and Chief Dennis Rubin. I've had some great guests, and I think the whole purpose is to, for me to bring them in so they can teach our listeners information. And I think what you just said earlier is that the character should be the number one aspect we're looking at when we're looking for people. What is the character?
Absolutely.
And what does that character offer us?
Let's take a step further from what you were saying, especially with regards to Joe DeVito. The guy's a rock star. He's starting to realize that he has a knack for teaching thermal imaging and explaining it in such a way that you can understand it. He's just a great overall guy. I got to meet him in Atlanta when I was down there at a conference. We had talked back and forth via Twitter, and then we actually had to sit down. So, like, totally amazed. And I was honored that he invited me to come down to Florida, where ultimately I met you. But I can kind of understand what you mean about being sad about running from room to room. The great thing about being a conference speaker is I get to meet so many people and I get to spread the message, at least in this case, of mental health. The downside to it is there's usually at least one other class in my time slot that I want to be at. So I'll look at the schedule and go, oh, I really want to, I'm going to be out in Firehouse World in March. And I'm looking at the time slots going, I want to go to that class. And I look, I'm like, oh, I'm lecturing. It's like, can I probably audio record myself and put a cardboard cutout up? So at least you still hear the same message and I can just sit in somebody else's class. But unfortunately, that doesn't really work out too well. But there's so many great speakers and great topics out there. And being a lifelong learner and a student of the fire service, I completely understand what you're saying. And I know I use podcasts to learn. I'm in the car. I drive an hour to work. So I pop on a podcast and I listen to something, and it's more productive than listening to usually talk radio or the same song 1,400 times on the radio.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I had this medical implant put in my back in early spring, and it changed my life and brought me back to being a real person again. And this summer I started walking, and I was walking up to about 2.5 miles. I've lost 30 pounds. And at first I was just using music to listen to. And then I started listening to my podcast that I had done the previous week. And then I saw there's just so many other podcasts out there with lots of topics that I'm interested in. So I started listening to a podcast when I would walk. So the walk would take me to do 2.5 miles was about somewhere between an hour and 15 and an hour and 30 minutes. And it was early in the morning. I was walking about 5:30 in the morning. And it was great. It was a great way to learn and not be distracted. I just think that it offers so much more. And there are some great, what really I'm happy about is how many great fire service podcasts are out there. I look them up all the time. I don't get to listen to a lot of them, but I see their topics. I see what they're doing. And I'm just honored that I can be a little bit a part of that, because most of those are people who are in the fire service, still in there. And I'm just one of those old farts who hasn't been in for over 30 years, but it's still part of me. And I think that learning is so important to me, and I think it will be to the end of my days. I still teach here in the community. I have a little school in my home. And I'm hoping, as I said earlier, that this message, your message, and all the messages from my guests help open new pathways for our firefighters, our EMS people, and our law enforcement people to think in new ways, in new directions that they maybe never even gave much thought to before. But after hearing, especially like this podcast today with you, there's so much that you offer that goes across the board, and not even just in first responders. It goes to almost any business today where you have employees. This whole concept of looking for the character applies to any business today. And
absolutely.
And I think it makes the difference. And I think you probably more than anybody else, you've been able to see the difference that it can make when somebody adapts the recommendations that you offer and the changes that you see happening subsequent to that decision, right?
Yes. It's like we said before, if you don't know the answer to a problem, find somebody who does. And I tell everybody, I consider myself a resource. At the end of every presentation that I do, the very last slide is my contact info. And there's some people out there that's like, oh, you know, email my website and, you know, we'll get back to you. Listen, my email is there and my cell phone number is there. My cell phone stays on 24/7. As I tell a story in one of the lectures that I did, where I had a guy that I used to work with who was contemplating suicide. And I was the last phone call that he made. And when I asked him why, he was like, because I knew you would pick up the phone. Hmm. And to me, that was, it was both terrifying under the auspices of, what if I hadn't answered and then I would have read in the paper the next day or the day after that he had done this? But the fact that he was willing to reach out and go, hey, I need help. I don't know who else to reach out to, so I reached out to you. So my thought has always been, hey, here's my cell number. If you don't know who else to call, call me. You could be from another state. I might not know the resources in your area, but I'll find them for you, or I'll keep you on the phone. We'll get you in touch with somebody, and we'll get you the help that you're looking for. Because if you have the strength, and that's really what it is, a lot of people, myself included, I used to think that if you committed suicide, that it was a weakness. Mm-hmm. And I've since adapted my mindset on that. You have to overcome everything in biology and everything in your nature to die, because everything in our human nature is to survive. Right. You think about if you're down the shore and you're in the ocean, you get knocked down by a wave, you get pushed under, you go to come back up and you get knocked down by a second wave. Well, now you're fighting for air and you're like, I need air, I need air, I need air. Well, in order to make that decision to die, you have to go, yeah, I need air, but it no longer is important to me. So if you were willing to reach out and go, hey, I need help, I'll help you find it. I might not be the guy for it, but I'm sure as hell going to do my best to help you find it, because I don't want to go to any more funerals. I've been to more than enough in my career. And sadly, I think there's going to be a lot more coming up. But if we can minimize those and we can get folks the help that they need, then all the time that I spend is absolutely worth it. All the time that I spend away from my family, traveling and lecturing, everybody goes, oh, it's so glamorous. You get to go to this place and this place. I'll be in Florida actually in 3 weeks for Fire Rescue East 2018. I'm literally on the ground for under 24 hours.
Where is that going to be?
I fly in. I go to, what's that?
Where is that going to be?
Daytona.
Oh, Daytona. Okay, good.
Daytona Beach. So I'll fly in, I'll land, I drive out to Daytona because I'm flying into Orlando. I go to sleep. I wake up the next morning. I lecture. Maybe I'll grab lunch with a couple of the other speakers that I know that are coming down there. I drive back to the airport. I get back on a plane and I fly home. It's a real glamorous lifestyle.
Yeah.
So
people always,
that's the sort of things that people don't see, is the amount of miles that you log on an aircraft. And sure. I'm a pretty tall guy. I'm 6'5". Most of those aircraft seats were not designed for people like me.
No, not at all. I'm 5'10 and a half, and I still have a tough time sitting in the seats the way they've been rearranged in today's jets and today's economy. Well, David, let's give the listeners your contact information. It will be posted on the new page that's coming on our website at www.dalmatianproductions.tv. And make sure you spell Dalmatian with an A, DALMATIAN. That is the correct spelling, even for the dog. DalmatianProductions.tv. We'll have a new page up with all our podcast guests alphabetically arranged, and with their contact information, if they have books available or links. We're going to have all that on the page. So, David, why don't you share that with the listeners right now for yourself?
Sure. The website is www.davidwiklanski.com. And if you need it, my cell phone number is 732-993-8457. Feel free to reach out. And if you don't know where else to turn, at least you know that I'll listen to you and I'll help you the best that I can to find the resources that you need. Because like I said, I'd rather not go to any more funerals in the course of my career.
Right. Well, that's the best reason of all to do the work that you're doing. And we're happy to do the work that we're doing to get this message out to the members of the fire service, EMS, and law enforcement. David, I can't thank you enough for being with us. I know you have a busy schedule, both in the fire service and your lecturing, and thank you for sharing some time with us and sharing this important message. And I hope that those of you who are listening, no matter what country you're in, this applies to all of you as well. So we're thankful that you listen to our podcast. We look forward to it. Send us If you're listening, please send us an email to dalmatprod@outlook.com. We'd love to hear from you and let us know which podcast you're listening to and what you like. If you have any ideas, you can send them as well. And David, again, my sincere thanks and appreciation. This is a great topic. I'm so happy I got to meet you at the Great Florida Fire School and that you were able to find some time to join us today. So thanks again very much.
Thank you very much, Steve.
All right, folks, we'll be right back right after these words. Please stay tuned.
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Steve Green, the creator and host of Five Alarm Task Force. I've truly enjoyed bringing you these podcasts almost every week. I've been lucky enough to have some of the best mentors and instructors in the fire service join me. We have covered many of the top issues facing the fire service both today and looking to the future. Our latest ratings indicate that our podcast is now being heard in South America, Europe, and the Philippines, as well as Australia and New Zealand. While we're thrilled with this information, we want to do more. One of our goals is to bring you live broadcasts from some of the major fire conferences around the country, and we have a few other ideas too. Since the beginning, I've shouldered all the costs from the professional equipment to high-speed broadband. When I started, quite a few people suggested I should charge subscription fees, but I couldn't do that. I'm sure that 99% of you are first responders. I could never charge colleagues, members of this great family of ours, to listen to these podcasts. Nevertheless, to take Five Alarm Task Force on the road, I do need your support. If you have enjoyed our podcast and want to help us do more, please visit the podcast page on our website at bit.ly/5alarmpodcast. Scroll down the page, and just before the recent podcast, you'll see a donate button. It's all secured through PayPal. If you like our work, please help us continue and improve it. You can also help us by spreading the word. Tell your friends about us and the work we're doing. We hope and pray that 2018 will be a safe and remarkable year for you and yours, and we know that's going to be a great one for Five Alarm Task Force too. Stay safe, and thanks for listening. We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Steve Green. For our regular listeners, you know we often include an editorial type of message in each podcast entitled My View, and this is it for now. We've all heard the term, close the door. A lot probably when we were kids. Our parents would say, close the door, we have company coming, I don't want them to see the mess in your room. Or, close the door, what do you think, I can afford to air condition the entire outside? Well, today that term, close the door, is making its rounds in the fire service, and it's doing us well. We're learning that by closing the door, if we come on a working fire scene, we can close that door, it can help prevent fire spread, we can wet that area down, and possibly open the door again with less of a backflash. However, we're going to need to add that term, close the door, to our fire prevention and fire education. As you all are probably aware, last Thursday night, the Thursday after Christmas, there was a terrible fire in the Bronx. Our brothers and sisters of FDNY made valiant efforts to save people. Many people were saved, and many resuscitations were tried. But alas, 12 innocent people lost their lives in that fire. The cause was determined relatively soon and early. A 3-year-old child was probably playing with the burners on the stove while his mother was in the shower and there was a 2-year-old child doing something else. She came out of the shower, she saw the smoke and flames and grabbed both kids and ran out of the building. Unfortunately, she left the front door to her apartment open and that doorway faced the stairwell leading upstairs to several floors. As we know from the fire service, that stairwell can act as a chimney flue. And that smoke and fire, as in this case, went straight up there and caused a massive fire in that building. Our brothers and sisters worked as hard as they could to extinguish and rescue as many people as possible. Nevertheless, that sad toll was taken. And perhaps from that we will learn something so that they have not died in vain. we must start stressing in our fire education and prevention programs the term close the door. We must teach our citizens when to close the door. We do now. We're trying to stress the fact of close the door in sleeping quarters, and that's spreading pretty well, but it needs more. We also need to let people know when they are leaving a possible structure fire, and they are, for all intents and purposes, certain that they are the last one out of that building. If it's possible at all, they should close the door. Close the door. It's something that we're going to have to work on. It's not going to be easy. But let's do it in memory of those 12 innocent people who passed away on that Thursday after Christmas. Close the door. That's my view.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
And that wraps another edition of 5 Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. We would like to thank our guest, David Wicklansky, for joining us to discuss resilience and how to survive the fire service. Did you know you can now find us and subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play? Just search for 5 Alarm Task Force. We also want to thank our promotional partners, Dalmatian Productions, the Firehouse Tribune, Fire Tech, Hennessy Distributing, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, and the Great Florida Fire School. Portions of instrumental music on 5 Alarm Task Force are courtesy of Lee Rosevere. Find more of his music at happypuppyrecords.ca. If you would like to be a guest with us or have a comment about a show, please drop us a line to dalmatprod@outlook.com. We want to know that we're bringing you the topics that you are interested in. You can follow us on Twitter at dalmatprod or at cause_origin. And stay up to date with all our podcasts, Dalmatian Productions news, and our blog at our new website, www.bit.ly/DalmatWeb. I'm Steve Green. Until next time, stay safe, and let's make sure everyone goes home.